Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everybody, welcome to the What Culture Gaming Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Telford, joined by Jules Gill.
Hello.
And Josh Brown.
Hello.
Now, it's been a bit of a big week for large game releases, such as, for example, Mortal Kombat 11, which gave me the idea for today's podcast, because I want to talk about the general idea of fan backlash and, you know, online communities and the way that I think that this generation especially has just gone down a really horrific route in terms of the over-monetization of the products themselves, the games themselves. And that's, we're seeing the fan communities respond to that by the likes of review bombing or the, like, yeah, attacking the devs on social media or whatever else. So I kind of just wanted to open the floor to that. Do you think that that's a good thing? Or like just the general conversation around this is the reality that we're in now?
I think that it's a better time than ever to have your voice heard as a gaming consumer. I feel like, for example, we obviously have our platform with What Culture. Most other people have like other social media things as well. And the ability to spread those thoughts out. And I feel like being able to share your thoughts, both positive and negative, is a very important thing for this society. However, I can personally say I don't like it when video game review bombing and stuff like that happens, because it actually affects the developers who probably started out, as everyone does, with fantastic intentions to make a good game, but somewhere along the line, publishers and other requirements have meant that bad stuff has happened along the way. Mm-hmm. So I feel like that is a personal attack against them and maybe not against the company itself.
I think it's a weird, like,
it's hard to separate the two, is what
I'm trying to say. But that's the thing, like, the only outlet that a whole bunch of fandoms have is to review bomb, assumedly, or to get on social media and try and target someone specifically if there's a member from that team that is a public face.
Yeah,
like a lot of people have a whole bunch of problems with you know, maybe they want to communicate something about Sekiro or a FromSoft game, but Hitaka Miyazaki is not on Twitter.
I mean, so. It's the thing, like, I'm very hypocritical in this sense, because I've jokingly said about Peter Molyneux, like, and stuff like that, like, my opinion against the man is actually come about because of my reflections of his games, whereas technically maybe
get a massive hand in
the thing that I think that's maybe the slight distinction is that he was the direct creative control behind a lot of the issues that I have problems with. But say you are just finding a lead developer of like Ubisoft, is it right to go and personally attack them because you didn't like how Far Cry New Dawn turned out? I don't think that is.
No, of course. I don't think it's ever going to be. It's never going to be okay to directly attack someone on social media. But I do think that all this kind of calls for some need to have a forum, like a dialogue between the two.
Yeah.
Because this generation, like I said, more than ever, we've seen all these monetization practices or DLC practices or microtransaction things. They are very anti-consumer, assumedly, or at least in their principle. And so you've kind of got the business side of it, the industry, the corporate side of it, going down this one route of, you know, we're going to kind of strangle the fandom in a way, and then it's resulted in all these backlashes and review bombings and everything else.
Well, it's very difficult in a way, isn't it? Because like the only way to get big publishers to listen to sort of backlashes to take a sledgehammer to it in a way, like when EA dropped Battlefront 2, like they only eventually changed because there was such a huge uproar, and like they got the most downvoted comment in Reddit history and stuff like that. But when that bleeds over to you are personally attacking specific people, that's when it's just dangerous and like completely not on. Like you can attack the idea of an amalgamation of a corporation or the idea of sort of like these faceless overlords. But when you drag people actually
like
into it.
Individuals who work.
Individuals. That's something else entirely. Like there is sort of cultivating a movement to inspire change. But when that passes over into simply attacking people or direct abuse, then what's that actually achieving? That's
useless. It's interesting because Jim Sterling has that concept, which is just like F Konami. That's the thing that he like popularized. Mm-hmm. That's attacking the company as a whole and its business practices. But he wasn't saying like F so-and-so because of this. And I think that that's a huge distinction if you put those two together.
Yeah, one of the, like I said, Mortal Kombat 11 released this week. And like the review that I did was the most angry I've ever been when I was recording something. Because I was genuinely so disappointed and so just genuinely just gutted and annoyed at the way that they'd set that game up.
But you love the game.
Yeah,
game itself, like, playing it is great.
The core of it, yeah. I mean, I still gave it 4 stars because trying to score something like that, it is that differentiation between the core components and the overall, the corporate side of it and everything like that. But to bring it back to what Josh was saying about, like, you know, like you sort of go after specific individuals, like there is that weird disconnect that we kind of keep having between the developers and the publishers and the assumption that the publishers are the corporate side and whatever. And then as different stories have come out in regards to like Destiny or Anthem, it's actually the developers that kind of went down that. It's a bit of a mix of the two. But in NetherRealm's case with Mortal Kombat, like Ed Boon was immediately on Twitter the day after the reviews broke. Yeah. And he was like, oh God, like we're really, really sorry. Like, sorry for the inconvenience. We're going to have a live stream tomorrow that will clear everything up. And we're going to go forward with changes immediately. And then NetherRealm did their combat cast the day after where they literally read a statement. It was the same two presenters that they always do every week. But they had a statement prepared that had clearly been handed to them from the PR so they could clear it up. But my point is that it's a differentiation between Warner Brothers, the faceless corporate overlords, and the developers, the people who are quote unquote on the front lines dealing with the fandom.
Yeah.
And they managed to kind of walk the line between the two. And Ed Boon, at no point was everyone like F Ed Boon or anything. No. It was like, we understand that the devs are separate to the corporate side.
But look at this in a really cynical way and think of that scenario as an entirely... almost like a fabrication. Mm-hmm. What if the if people didn't react badly to it, they would have carried on with that business.
Well, this is the larger point.
And so therefore, the fact that he was so quick to go on Twitter, the fact that he had a statement ready, the fact that they had the combat cast ready to go, meant that there was always almost a plan B in place. Mm-hmm. So therefore, it's kind of negative in a way because it feels like it's being set up.
Well, my thing.
If no one complained, they would have got away with it. But if they did, they're like, ah, we tried anyway, lads. Yeah. But we got this backup plan
so
in
like,
place.
My thing was like, I felt justified doing the review the way that I did because it did result in change, and change needed to come to that game.
Definitely.
But to your point, like, they obviously knew what they had when they were going into it. You'll never really know the deep dive as to whether that was a publisher whim or a developer whim. As to like who is NetherRealm's Andrew Wilson essentially.
Yeah.
And it's like, you're never really gonna know that unless like Jason Schreier like does a deep dive or something.
But
it did result in change, and immediate change as well, like whether that's up for the financial reality of not having the latest Mortal Kombat be a bomb or whatever, but it has worked out.
It raises questions as well, because I was told a while back that in order to get patches and stuff put through on your games, you have to go through quite a lengthy process with either Microsoft, Sony, Nintendo, whoever you're working with, and you have to sort of wait for release windows, you have to wait for these updates to be going. And yet, these guys are able to change the prices of their in-game currencies and all of their stuff overnight, straight away.
Well, that's,
but it makes me think of all those times that I've been told that, oh, you have to wait until the patch comes out in 2 or 3 weeks' time.
Yeah.
That was lies.
Not necessarily.
It depends
what's being changed. Because in Mortal Kombat's case, the thing that they're changing is AI aggression or whatever, and the pricing inside the crypt.
Yeah.
Inside the living towers, they're changing the modifiers. All of that is part of the live service. They built it in a way that they can live tweak that stuff. As opposed to like patching in a change about a level or something.
Okay.
That's kind of a change over time though, which I did have a note for in this, is that in like years gone by, we just accepted the game that we bought was the game. You don't even think about changing it. But now when something goes wrong, and I was very much aware of this during the review for Mortal Kombat, I was like, if I mention these problems in a big enough kind of scale, like, we do have a platform, it's kind of worth putting them out there, but there is that assumption now that you can change the thing that you had because you don't like
this. It's sort of a point of contention for me, because obviously when it's something like this that is very anti-consumer and quite predatory, like, you want to make a change, you want to get your voice heard, you want to sort of rally the people and try to alternate the actual product itself. But for me, there is a line to be drawn between sort of standing up against kind of bad business practices and then also sort of demanding you have your way, like you being the fans, to the detriment of what the developers actually intended. Like, I go back to Mass Effect 3 and how outraged I genuinely was at the time. I was so frustrated at that ending, and I wanted the extended cut. But looking back on it now, is it not like partly entitlement that sort of got that ending in the end. Like, obviously the fans deserved a good ending or something, but that's the ending BioWare wanted to put out, and that's what they went with. Mm-hmm. At what point does the fan demands of, you know, like, actual endings or actual mechanics or actual features be changed, like become a problem. Like, obviously, it's fine in this context, but if you set a precedent, it's like then you have to sort of acknowledge it all the time.
It's because of maybe an industry that's completely told us that we are the ones in control of it. We vote with our wallets, and the companies will bend over backwards to basically get whatever it is. And we're always told, no matter where we turn, that games are all meant to be inclusive now. Mm-hmm. However, that inclusivity approach has sometimes been confused with meddling with a creator's design. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't go into an art gallery and tell somebody how to paint it differently because you don't like it. And I think that games have to be treated in the same medium as films, music, things like it is the creator's output, mm-hmm. and it will not be for everyone. You cannot appease everyone. There are tweaks you can make mm-hmm. to make sure that it is fair and that there's as little a barrier to entry as possible, but you can't go out there and just say this game doesn't have a grappling hook mm-hmm. and I want this grappling hook to be in this game mm-hmm. and it does. It's not the same, but the Sekiro harder difficulty thing. Yeah. I understand why people wanted that in, because people wanted to enjoy the game, and I believe that they have every right to try and enjoy that game, but you are fundamentally asking somebody to change their game entirely to fit your desire.
That's a really good example. The Mass Effect one's a good one too, because like in the Sekiro example, it was just separating out accessibility from difficulty, because assumedly no one was asking for the game itself to be made easier, and more people could have a chance to fail equally. That was just, you know, you lower the barrier of entry, or you make the barrier of entry more accessible, or whatever. The Mass Effect thing, at the time, I was like, give me the ending that I deserve or whatever. Even though in hindsight, and I remember some people saying it at the time, that they should have just stuck to their guns, because that is the ending they want to put out, and that's it. I think that they yielded, personally, I think that they yielded, because if you look at the development of it, it was such a mess. And they'd already gone back and forward, with this other scrapped ending and whatever. So I think they felt that they owed it to themselves to put something out. So I like to believe it was their choice to elaborate on that ending.
I feel really sorry for the developers who have worked on projects like that. Like, take Ken Levine when he did Bioshock Infinite, or even Bioshock in the first place. He wanted to make it a text adventure, or like a sort of like point and click at one point. And they said to him like that you have to include shooting elements because shooters sell.
Right.
And imagine having your core design completely changed. Mm-hmm. I feel sorry for the people who worked on the Mass Effect thing because of the ending. Because like you say, that is clearly the ending they wanted to tell. Doesn't mean that it was a good ending.
The thing though. Like it went down to that. But then obviously because of the a newer generation, like just the fact of that what the internet provides, like an open dialogue or a potential dialogue between consumers and creators, you get that realization that actually they weren't very happy with it and they did want to go back, and to some degree they wanted to expand on it. And does that make it more valid?
I feel like you have every right to use the internet to request what you would like. It doesn't mean that you're going to have your prayers answered.
Yeah, you're not owed anything.
You're not. People say, oh, well, I put my money into it. That's your choice. No one is saying to you, you have to buy that £40 game, £50 game every time it comes out. Like, I understand if you're not happy with your purchase, but I can't. It's hard to put into words, because I don't want to come across like an asshole by saying that you can't just demand what you want from a game because you are fed all of the necessary information. However, this does lead into the counterpoint, which is we are not fed all of the information we need to
get.
And that's what I was trying to make, is that we're not fed the right information.
Publishers have, it's not just like us who have made this difficult. Like, publishers, by doing these horrible kind of predatory business practices and not telling you everything you need to know and obscuring things from you before launch, they've sort of cultivated this response from players who get these games that aren't what they expect or have been sold something different, and then they want change, and then that change is obviously fine because that's like, it's what the game should have been in the first place, but that sort of ends up blurring the line across the entire board of like demands.
Imagine if Shadow of War had come out and said, here's the trailer, here's what you'll be playing as, and now here's a little special bit. You'll be able to use your money to do this and blah, blah, blah. I reckon if they'd put if they'd advertised that and put all of that in their front and center, people have been like, well, I know what to expect. I don't like it, but I might not choose to buy it because of that. I won't buy it and then suddenly be horrified to find it in my game.
It's almost like a question of degrees, because they did mention that you were going to be able to get orcs from the salesman and that you would, I'm sure they mentioned that they could be purchased with real money. They definitely said the orc store was going to be in there.
Yeah.
But not in as much as saying that how much it was going to affect the progression of the game,
because it was
the backlash for that game.
It was the amount of pop-ups that were telling you to buy stuff.
And the difficulty spikes.
Yeah, the call to action that you required you to almost pay to.
And that was the thing with NetherRealm as well. It was just like, like in their all their combat casts, they were like they did a new character every week or every 2 weeks, and they didn't showcase the Living Towers, and they didn't showcase how much time crystals were, which is the premium currency that was going to affect everything else. They didn't really showcase that stuff, so it got to launch, and it was all of a sudden it was like, oh, so there's this massive grind, but I can just pay to bypass it. That and that immediately felt horrible, and it was that thing where you had to address the live element side of it, where it's like they can just tweak some figures to maximize their the profit kind of thing, and the loophole is the live section, because there are so many games that have these live elements where, like, you know, it's not finished when you buy it, and they can tweak something further down the line. I mean, one example that Rich gave me was Black Ops 4. They introduced a whole microtransaction store after launch, so they missed the hype window or the review period.
I feel like that's so underhanded.
So that's one, I've got two examples for that. There's obviously going to be more, but Black Ops 4 did that. All the review scores came in, the general hype window, it made massive amount of sales, and then they put the microtransaction store in later. Metal Gear Solid 5, all the reviews are extremely positive for the most part, minus some of the story stuff, and then later on, Konami changed the entire economy of the game so that you can't even maintain a mother base without paying for it.
It's ridiculous.
It's like, but people, that's the other thing, is people don't then talk about it because the spotlight's moved on, which forces people to do review bombs, get online, attack the developers, whatever it is, and that's a massive problem. But it's like those live elements being changed over time. I think the cynic in me thinks that, like, a lot of publishers or the corporate whims of whichever financial part of the developer takes advantage of those live services to change things further down the line.
Well, it comes in with, like, their responses to a lot of these backlashes as well, because for the first few weeks or something, they're never sort of open to discussion. No publisher or developer will ever admit that they've done something wrong or failed. They'll try to spin it and try to reassure people and say that, oh, you know, it's player choice or whatever, like
that.
It
wasn't going to be like that.
Yeah.
You don't need to buy the microtransactions.
Exactly. And then sometimes it comes across as, like, arrogance or just the desire to not want a conversation at all. Like, there is always a barrier between consumers and producers in that way, and I think that's why people end up, like, attacking people, because that it's a more personal thing on, like, Twitter or something, which is absolutely toxic and horrible. But when, like, the anomalous company comes out who is faceless and does not receive any personal backlash from saying things, like, has a response that is so arrogant. Like, I remember when the Xbox One came out, and they were saying, like, what do we do if we don't have online and stuff? And they were like, well, just stick with the 360. That's fine with you. And it's just, that's not a way to...
It comes across as callous.
Exactly,
it?
It's callous. Yeah. It's not a way to approach the people who are actually buying a game, and there is no kind of personality or even sort of humanity to those messages. It's so obviously manufactured and artificial and trying to put a positive spin on everything that, you know, it just frustrates players even more. Like, there needs to be a dialogue of some sort. Like, you don't have to take on everything that players say, obviously. That's obviously a problem in itself. But you need to at least acknowledge what they're saying and try to provide a honest human response.
I have to admit that, like, playing devil's advocate again, is that it must be incredibly hard to balance these, what the audience will want and what you will need to do to...
When to put your foot in the ground.
Yeah, because it's like everyone complains about these microtransactions, and yet people still buy them. They wouldn't be a necessary, air quotes, necessary practice of the gaming industry if people didn't buy them. Yeah. So somebody out there is buying a hell of a lot.
Oh, in their droves as well. Like, yeah.
And you know what? Those people might not be the type of people listening to this podcast. They might not be the ones listening to any sort of outsider thoughts saying, maybe you don't need to spend your money on this. Maybe you need to try. Maybe you need to struggle. Maybe you need to fail and not have everything handed to you. But they won't be listening to that because they'll be too busy buying loot boxes.
Yeah. I think that's true. I think it's like a different part. It's like a different conversation because, like some games have those elements where you can just bypass stuff and pay to bypass it. Something like Apex Legends launched with a full microtransaction store centered around its aesthetics and cosmetics, and that went down extremely well.
Because it was free. There was no barrier to entry there.
The grind that's in Apex is quite manageable. Like, if there's a skin that you want, you'll be able to get it in a good, like, I mean, it's probably changed now, but 15 to 20 matches, maybe. And you know exactly what you're going to get. The problem with Mortal Kombat 11, again, just as a contemporary example, is that you can't pinpoint what you want and get it. And that disconnect of just going like, okay, I just need to throw myself at a grind wall.
Yeah.
That's a thing that's immediately annoying and unfair.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy, because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
A great example of showing how grinding to unlock something versus grinding to unlock potentially nothing you want is look at Smash Brothers. Yeah. Smash Brothers tells you exactly what's on the disc, what every fight is going to be, and people know what to expect from the franchise. And all you need to do, the requirements to unlock it, are play the game for X number of hours or X number of matches, and you will eventually get challenged, beat them, and you'll unlock them. That is a grind that works because it encourages you to play to get more gameplay out of it. But like you're saying, it's not being able to choose what you want. If they just gave you in that crypt a list of what's in there and exactly where it's located, and it was a fixed thing, you'd just be like, that is fine. I don't mind, because I will pick the stuff I want and I will leave the stuff I don't. But this is just the company just saying, well, you know what? Somebody might have spent an afternoon working on that skin. That of like this, I don't know, like a Burger King skin that no one really wants, but they want us to push this. So we're going to make sure that's random. So you might randomly get a burger hat or a burger shoe. Ooh, do you like your lettuce hands?
Yes.
Jules is never going to develop a Mortal Kombat game for the betterment of us all. But I think you can drill that down though to even more, that idea of specificity. I think that that correlates with the idea of a consumer purchasing a product. Like you're putting money down to buy a thing, and it assumedly has to have specific parameters as to what you're purchasing. And so when you remove the specificity at the core of that product that you bought, then that leads immediately to anger, because you don't know what you just bought. You can't access the thing that you want.
Imagine trying to explain this to a younger like a younger person who has not really experienced sort of like video games before. Sitting them down. Okay, what do I do here? Oh, you fight. Brilliant. How do I unlock that character, or how do I unlock this thing for it? Well, you've got to fight some more and you get some money. Okay, cool. That makes sense. And then you've got to take your money and you've got to throw it in a wishing well and hope that you get it.
Yeah.
Oh, why can't I just buy that one outright? Well, you could if you had the season pass, because the season pass probably had, and then it's just, when you explain it to someone like that, that's not a game anymore. That's like trying to, that's like trying to manage a business.
But
like,
that's, in a way, I mean, I've told a story anecdote on the podcast before, but one of my friends' kids was, I think they were playing Souls, and they died, and they said, where's the microtransaction store? How do I buy more souls?
Mad how it's been,
but,
like.
Yeah, and it's like, because these practices are so prevalent everywhere, like, again, cynic in me thinks, on the corporate side, I think they think that if they hold out long enough, they will raise a generation of gamers that are completely comfortable with all this stuff.
Yeah.
And then that'll be, I mean, that's why I think these backlashes are so important. But that's what I think that they're holding out for, because if you, like any young human will gravitate and accept whatever's put in front of them for the most part. And if this is the landscape of gaming, then that's what people have grown up with.
Well, like,
which is horrifying.
Yeah, because I mean, you don't even think, like, when we talk, it's obviously about people like our age or like older and stuff who remember when cheats would unlock you new skins and stuff like that, and when stuff
you got
like
a full game.
A full game, essentially, but there will be so many people who did not grow up with that and now just take this as the norm. And even me personally, like, I would usually never ever buy like a skin in a single player game, but now I'm tempted to because that's my only option, and like this is all that happens now. And I find myself buying bloody Pokeballs on Pokemon Go.
At least that's free.
Exactly, but that's free. But then once you start doing it on free-to-play games, the distinction between the games you're actually paid for just kind of eventually goes away. Like, mm-hmm. if it's normalized there, then it doesn't feel all that bad when you eventually do it on a paid game,
well,
which is insidious. Exactly.
Yeah,
but
the
thing is, I don't want to think that, and that is bad. And a lot of people, no doubt, if they're listening to this, will just say, well, don't do it then. Maintain that distinction. But it is genuinely hard. Once you start normalizing that in a different context, you can easily bring it over to a fully priced game.
Which is the thing that carries forward to the new generation coming up with it. If they're used to recurrent spending models, again, then that's the kind of thing that they look for and accept.
I just wish that that the recurrent spending models led to a slight decrease in the price of the video game itself. I just wish that there was actually some sort of like a payback for, like, if we're going to accept this, if somebody came in and just said, Jules, they will be, it won't be £60 a game anymore, be £40 a game or £30 a game.
Or free.
Or free, whatever. But you will be occasionally asked to pay for that. I'd be like, you know what? Fair dinkums. Yeah. Like, you got me there. Like,
which boils back down to the idea that you're paying for a product. Because for that example, Dead or Alive 5, when they re-released it as Final Round, I think it was called, it's all free. But the base game is free, so you get like a certain amount of the roster and you can just play for free. And you buy all the individual characters if you want. You plug them back into that roster.
Which game is it?
Dead or Alive 5. Not the new one.
Do you mean Killer Instinct?
Nope, I mean Dead or Alive 5.
Oh, okay, fair.
Unless Killer Instinct did the same thing.
They might have had a season.
Either way, you can buy this like free version, ostensibly, where you have like a certain amount of the roster. I think you start with like Kasumi and a couple of others. And then you buy, really specifically, you buy exactly which of the characters you want to plug into that roster. And then that's
fine.
Well, right, so like that was them kind of experimenting with a different like way of doing a AAA, whatever, brand new premium thing, but segmenting it down the monetization route or segmenting it down a mobile gaming route to see how people would take to it. And I never looked too much at the backlash to that, but I didn't mind that as an idea because it gets around the unit price.
As long as the full cost of the full roster isn't extreme. If the full cost for the full roster was £100, then you would see it as being like, oh, I'm
well, I think
scammed.
They still had the option to purchase the full game. Like, it was still a thing. It was just that if you wanted to like sidestep that, I think they were experimenting with it. But that's the thing. The corporate side, the answer on the business side for the unit price thing would just be that the only reason that games are the price that they are and that they're not more is because you can offset the cost of production and development by having microtransactions, and they insist that they're necessary.
And I've said it many, many times. It's not up to us to foot their bills, but I understand the need and the desire for every single person who's ever manufactured a game to make it a success, and success equals sales, or sales equals success.
I think the thing that a lot of us just like, the thing that goes back and forth, and I think this will change the more eyes get, the more Jason Tries there are in the world, or the more making of documentaries that there are, the more lights get shown on the production process, because we just have to accept that game production is incredibly hard, and it obviously is, but that those goals change so much, and therefore production budgets go out of control and whatever. So.
I just wish that there was a level of transparency where if I know that if I'm buying a game, X percentage of this is going forward to make sure that the staff members who work at that development studio have another job for another year. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to think to myself, oh, I've just bought Mortal Kombat 11 and I've paid for the season pass, and that money is just going straight into Mr. Warner Brothers' back pocket.
This is a really, really interesting point, because we live in a time where mass layoffs are a thing. We've got all these reports about how poorly devs are treated and how like they have terrible like job security and stuff. So when you're paying for these microtransactions and you know that it's not going to contribute to an industry that you love, it's going to support a game that you love and a developer you love, but in a really nebulous way that doesn't guarantee anything. I'm not inclined to spend the money on it. It seems so blatant and obvious and genuinely greedy that I don't want to, like you said, I don't want to line Mr. Warner Brothers' pockets. I want to help and support the devs that have slaved over this game and have really put everything into it. Like, that's who I want to support. And when I'm playing a game like Rainbow Six Siege, like, I've played that game for like 3 years straight, so I don't mind spending some more money on it to support them because they've continued updating the game in a way that I think is fair and has added a lot of content, and I know that that's like going straight to the devs to help continue this game. Whereas in another position, like what you were just saying there, Jules, it's I don't want to do it, and I don't think
that,
it's
Siege
good
example
optics.
Though, like, that's still Ubisoft. Like, it's still like that assumption that big Ubisoft should be able to pay the wages, kind of thing.
The difference there though, I think, is Ubisoft have sort of, they've always kind of stood by their developers more. With Warner Brothers, every game they've released in the past couple of years has always had this sort of greediness, this
Shadow of War. Mortal Kombat,
Arkham Knight came out and it was like broken on the PC, and they didn't want to focus on that because they wanted to focus on the expansions
and
first and the DLC.
To refuse to fix a game is,
well, it didn't make financial sense for them to keep doing it.
But isn't that mind blowing? Like, I understand that, I'm sorry that you messed up and it's going to cost you, but to deny an entire platform of a game because you can't be bothered to fix it is ridiculous.
They just didn't want to allocate the funds to it because at that point, the sales were everywhere else and they were just like, well, we can just scrap this and move on.
I'm still fuming about that.
Yeah, that was a very like cold, hard cash approach to it. Mm. One of the examples that I had down here, because I had a list of like Mortal Kombat 11, Shadow of War, Battlefront 2, those games, because of fan backlashes, have been made into way more like palatable, enjoyable products. Like Mortal Kombat 11, as a quick addendum to the review, is in a much better state even now than it was when I reviewed it like 4 days ago or whatever it was. Time was a blur before Endgame. But whenever I first did Mortal Kombat 11, those things seem to have worked out. I also had No Man's Sky down on here because...
you've been banging on about this, saying that we need to go back and play this now.
The whole world does.
Because this is the game that you feel like they promised before.
That's the fascinating thing, because when they first launched it, I actually always loved No Man's Sky. I always have since day one. Yeah. I almost gave a game of the year in 2016 because I'm an insane person. But they, pardon me, have gone so much back to the drawing board and have like, you know, looked at the community, looked at the backlash. Obviously, the controversy around its launch was almost unprecedented considering the platform that they were on. And it ties into what you were saying, Josh, about like the idea that you're giving money to the devs. Like Hello Games are a pretty small team, or they certainly were when they first made it. But all of these like points kind of come full circle because obviously there was a version of No Man's Sky that was advertised and the Sean Murray completely played into. Mm-hmm. And that's become the version that they've then developed across the last 3 years post-launch. Whereas that, for me, I still love No Man's Sky, but what that thing initially released as was what Sean Murray said it was going to be, this chill, exploration-heavy game.
Yeah.
But they've now put in the multiplayer components and they've put in like combat and stuff like that. And it's become the version that I don't even know if it was the core fans have asked for, but it's become the mediated overall backlash version, which is kind of fascinating to roll everything together. Because in subsequent interviews, Sean Murray said that like this isn't what we set out to do, but I like what it's become. Yeah. And like for me, like I actually prefer the quieter, original exploration-heavy version.
But you
wouldn't have the new one without all that feedback.
I would have much more sympathy if we didn't have him on record saying, when he was answering those questions, saying, will it have this? Yes, because that's him propagating a lie.
Yeah, of course.
But that's completely fine, because if he'd gone out on his mission statement and said it's just a chill exploration game, I would have totally been fine with it.
But
we wouldn't have had a backlash in the first place.
Yeah, well, that's the thing with that. That rolls everything together in terms of developments and production budgets going crazy. Mm. The idea that like when a game the development goals at the very beginning change over time. Mm. Like I think Sean Murray's a good dude. Like I think he's like a good-hearted, good dude.
He's an incredibly nervous man, and I feel like I cannot say with a clear conscience that if I was put on stage in front of hundreds of thousands of people with microphones shoved in my face and somebody asked me not a leading question but a simple question, I might have got it wrong.
I think at that time that's what he wanted to put in there as well.
Imagine that, just being sat there and somebody said, is this game going to have a multiplayer? Mm-hmm. And in your brain you go, no, or not really, but all that comes out of your mouth is, kinda. You've then said on record for the rest of the world that you were going to put in multiplayer. Where's the multiplayer game stuff? And he's just like,
Like also addressed that, like as that thing started to snowball, that like those opportunities came up. Like, oh, do you want to go on the Colbert Show? And it's like, as a small team, it literally was like 14 people, 12 people made that first version of the game. They've hired a lot since then. But he talked about like, well, you're given the opportunity. Would I regret it if I didn't do it? So they took it. Yeah. I think it's a different conversation, but I think that, you know, that idea of like the fan impact, the media backlash impact, like has, if you're going to pick one game that's completely transformed since launch day, like this, like the version of No Man's Sky as it is now is the version, the fake version that was the bigger promised version.
No Man's Sky, to me, even though like we've talked about it there, like Jules, you were saying, like there was a lot of things that you said on record weren't true, but it's just, for me, like the backlash to that was so total. There was no real room for nuance or anything like that. No real kind of considerations to how much development changes and how the things you might have talked about in interviews and wanted to implement simply couldn't happen due to time and like the marketing machine and the thing you're involved in, the snowball effect. But the backlash was so total to it, I thought. You were either on one side or on the other, and there was very little room for discussion in the middle. I'm sure there was some, but that's not what you saw all over the place. And for that, it was even worse because, like you said, it was a small team. It was Sean Murray as a person, as a face, as a developer, getting the brunt of the backlash. I felt that was kind of like so... uncomfortable to sort of follow.
I mean, ever since then, like, they literally, I mean, they went radio silent. They stopped tweeting altogether. He stopped tweeting, and they just, all the money that they made, because it still sold an absolute ton, they funded that back into the game, and they started making the version that the world clearly thought it was going to be. But they, you know, they went, like I said, they went radio silent for a good 2 years. Like, it was a long time before they came back up again.
I can't imagine what that must have been like for the developers at the time, because
they had to save the company as well.
Like, it must have been incredibly stressful and incredible, like, amount of mental pressure on Sean himself to lead his team and to know that he's got to fix this or feel the desire to fix this. Like, this is a very hard industry to be an independent developer in the first place. So, you know, it's okay. It's okay. We'll get there in the end.
I think to bring it all back around, because we've done like a good half hour, do we think that the version of No Man's Sky that as it ended up, is that a good thing? Or should they have stuck to what they put out and said, no, this is what we wanted?
It's funny because you will hear people saying that it's a product that's been designed by testing groups, and you say that's a bad thing. Yet No Man's Sky is a product that has been reactively changed by the testing groups of the actual market themselves.
And it's still all the more impressive now, but it absolutely is not what they set out to do initially.
But to answer your question is, I don't have an answer for that because I feel like compromising your original idea to make something popular is not good for you.
Or to satisfy a backlash.
But to make your game successful by making good on promises is good. It's hard.
I think that's why it's one of the most fascinating examples of it. That's one of the things that keeps me... And like I said, I still love No Man's Sky, but it is interesting. And its path across the last, like, 3 years now is kind of insane.
Yeah. I mean, I don't really know how much of what it's turned into now is a direct response to the backlash. Because, I mean, like, when that happened, you would have got so many people. The most vocal people would never have touched that game again just because of, like, they want to stick to their guns. They're going to give it the biggin. And I think it's only kind of, like, the core fans that might have, like, came back to it, or people who might have been more lenient at the time, who weren't sort of, like, so vocal and so one side or the other. Whereas I think that's potentially okay. It depends, because I don't think Sean Murray, again, I'm not speaking for the man, but I don't think you sort of... No Man's Sky is designed entirely to respond to that backlash. I think it's become something else entirely, but I don't think that's purely from a reactionary perspective. It may just be building on what they had.
Maybe it was the roadmap. It was always going to turn up. Or at least
I think some of the features, we can maybe do a whole separate thing on it, I think, or like an editorial on it or something. Because when they eventually came back up for air after that like massive radio silence, it was literally, here's a trailer with a tick box reaction to everything people hated. And then having followed all the patch notes, it literally did become that. It was like, you guys hated like these 50 things. We have fixed these 50 things. And they have like new ideas and stuff in there. They've now turned it into this big old like MMO type thing. But as a huge fan, it felt like they were kind of doing what people thought it was supposed to be.
Just remember, there are loads of examples of games that started out as one thing, failed at what they were, and came back stronger. You look at Final Fantasy 14, completely botched its launch and has come back fine. Battlefront 2, now, actually, if you were to sit down and just play it today, is fantastic.
It's one of the best Star Wars games.
I absolutely love it. And I liked it even while all the backlash was going on, because I didn't put a penny into that game. I got a free review copy. I didn't have to... I spent nothing on that game. So my investment on it was just time. You know what I mean?
Even the gameplay was like solid back then. Yeah. The wider stuff. But yeah, it is that wider stuff that I think invites the most conflict, to quote an Avengers thing. And I think that's the stuff that is the most worthwhile to address. It's just separating the core staff from the wider sort of machinations of the corporate side of it. I don't know. I guess like going forward, something like Mortal Kombat 11, they can make that into the best version of itself. And
gameplay-wise, I had an absolute blast playing with you on the live stream. I honestly
felt
you're
on the floor trying to get up.
Well, to be honest, I felt that was one of the most balanced fighting games I've played in a long time. So
I think going forward, it is just maintaining that side of it that comes from, I don't know, the devs or the people that have the players in mind kind of thing.
Exactly. Like don't attack specific people. No. Like, there'll be so many people who worked on Mortal Kombat who put blood, sweat, and tears into that game. Like, you want to champion those people, even if like the business practices aren't great and maybe some of the creatives made some bad decisions. Like, don't get too personal.
Don't specify specific things.
Exactly that, guys.
Well, no, do specify specific things. But yeah, it is worth separating the two out. But for now, this has been the What Culture Gaming Podcast. You guys can all find us on social media. I am at @LP89, and I've been your host, Scott Tilford, joined by Jules Gill.
Hey, guys, you can follow me at RetroJ with a 0 over on Twitter.
And Josh Brown.
You can follow me at Josh Brown with 2 O's. at twitter.com.
I'll catch you guys next time.
Bye. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.